So this is the second day of this four-day retreat here in Tampa, the path to wholeness. Obviously, the path to wholeness is the path away from separation, disconnection, being in pieces. Healing means becoming whole, returning to wholeness. So there are some questions here. I won't spend a lot of time with them because we didn't really get into the teaching yesterday, and it's like giving a Dharma talk in a floral shop. A little over the top, but how wonderful. Flowers are wonderful. What about our natural instinct for survival? There's a story of the boy who laughed outside, the one about the boy and the wolves. I'm not sure what about our natural instinct for survival, other than obviously, as Alex I'm sure could confirm, there is this kind of biological imperative that's been cultivated over centuries and centuries, right? Even from prehistoric times, perhaps. The body wants to live. So that's true. But the ego is very happy. It wants to live at others' expense. That is the difference between those who live from their instincts and those who live from their higher mind, might say. That is a great difference. Could I say something about joyful effort? Joyful is underlined. So there is effort and joyful effort. Effort is something I think all of us know, right? Work. And we like to work. Right? Right, Chris? Give us a project and we will kill ourselves to get it accomplished. Right? We love to work. We all know about effort. We make efforts in our work. We make efforts in our school, our academic training. We make efforts in other types of activities. We know about making effort. But most of us do not know about joyful effort. Many of us go about our work quite serious. Our work is serious stuff. Most of us go around our work out of a sense of duty and responsibility. Many of us go about our work joyless because they're actually we feel the activities of work are things that are imposed upon us. For many people, school is not a joyful experience. Training is not a joyful experience. And their work is not a joyful experience. It's something they do to earn money or for other reasons, but it's not happiness. And even though we often go about our work, wanting to do a competent job, wanting to do a quality job, there's no joy in it. It's often joyless, which is sad in a country where people work so much. So now we have this transformation, this path of transformation and healing, enlightenment, wholeness that we are undertaking, and it does take effort. It does take energy. It does take diligence. It takes many of the qualities that are also needed at work. But the Buddha's teaching calls it joyful effort. And for many people, that is a mystery. When we undertake something joyfully, we undertake it because we are happy to do it, and the doing of it brings us happiness. It's really both. It's not one or the other. So what does that mean? In this practice, this Dharma practice, the mind state of a practitioner is the mind state of someone who has been very thirsty and has now found water. Can you feel the happiness in that? Someone who has been very hungry and has now found food. Can you feel the happiness in that? Somebody who has been lost, wandering about, and now has found the road to take them where they want to go. Someone who has been alone and finally found a friend. Is that clear? It is that mind that we come to Dharma with. So we approach Dharma with happiness, with joy. How fortunate I am that in this Saha world, in this world of impermanence, cause and effect, things endlessly changing, in this world where there's so much garbage, so much noise, so much falsity, so much phoniness, so much junk food of experience, so many false teachers, so many hypocrites, so many people who talk the talk but don't walk the walk, right? In the midst of all that, there is this precious thing, this Dharma path. 2,600 years of experience and wisdom that has come down to us to this present moment, and that there are teachers alive, still alive, awakened beings who are still alive, who not are just teaching us from what they learned through study, but teaching because they have the same realization as those in the past. They speak from experience, right? So we know it's not just Dharma, it's not something we read about, something the ancients practiced that now we're trying to emulate or figure out. We have living teachers who are walking the same path as the ancient ones, so they can show us clearly how to practice, how to understand, and how to practice, and how to transform. How precious! Where else in the world do you find this? It is rare. When you find a rare, precious jewel, what do you do with it? Right? If you're digging around in your backyard and all of a sudden you find a big diamond, I mean, what do? Do you just, ignore it? Put it in the trash? What do you do with it? Or do you take it in? Yeah, you bring it in the house. You polish it and clean it. You put it in a special place. It's something precious, right? You treat it that way. That's the mind state of someone who approaches Dharma. Now you get into the work, right? And, and we go about it the same way. It's work. It's something I got to do. people resent having to do it. People don't like having to do it. People resent the teacher for, you know, they sign up for retreat and then on the way there, like, what the hell am I doing here? Things get a little rough during retreat, you know. They don't find that they have the mind that they think they deserve or aren't having the experience they expected and, you know, they want out, right? I mean, you know, it's that same miserable mind. We are walking a path that will deliver. That is assured. How do I say that? Because this is a path that for years, millions and millions and millions and millions of people have walked and have transformed themselves. Right? By the same practices, hearing the same teachings that we are hearing right now. Right? So healing and transformation is assured if we just walk the path. There's great happiness in that. But there's something else beside knowing that I'm walking a path that will eventually, in the short term, the medium term, the long term, will deliver and free me from my suffering, all my sufferings, all my neuroses, all my habit energies can be healed and transformed, and I have the capability of being a Buddha. So that's personally a very, a lot of happiness in that, right? But it's even better than that. Because I understand that I have a deep connection to other beings in this world. Family, friends, colleagues, on and on and on. Who are suffering emotional afflictions, the ordinary ups and downs in life are a burden to them. They want happiness and they don't know how to find it. They want happiness and they do things that only create more suffering for themselves and others. Well, hopefully, when I get it and I can do it for myself, I will then have the ability, the gift, and the tools to bring a benefit to others. Right. So that makes the whole process of what I'm doing, I mean, happy. How wonderful. How wonderful that I can participate in this thing that'll give great benefit. Hopefully some in the present, but I know much more in the future when I am transformed. How wonderful. You know, how happy that I can work, that my work will benefit others. So this is the way we think in this Dharma path. We don't just think it once. We think it every day. Until you get it. Right? When we become masters, we get it. It's so integrated, we don't have to reflect in this way anymore. But until then, we have to reflect. And especially reflect when, you know, when you get discouraged, when it becomes work, when a blah, 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 blah. Right? That's when you have to really take out the things I just said and reflect in this way. Because we are lost in our egocentricity. Our self-centeredness, right? And even though we have vowed to undertake this wonderful path of healing, enlightenment, and transformation, and to help all sentient beings, right? As soon as the going gets a little rough, we go, gee, I could be doing so many more fun things, you know, sitting here listening to Fred. I could be home watching my soaps. I don't know. What? Well, today is Gasparilla. I could be dressed as a pirate. Drunkenly marauding through downtown. You know what I mean? There's so many more fun things to do in life. Why am I here? If you don't know why you're here, you need to reflect so you know why you're here. You're not here because of authority or duty or responsibility. You're here because you want to awake and you want to do anything you can to nurture your awakening, and you want to benefit beings, and you have to train. Sorry, you have to train. You know, you want to be a doctor, you got to go to medical school. You want to be an electrician, you got to train. You want to be a cook, you got to train. I mean, you know, there's no way around that. This is training. So that's it on joyful effort. There's a more technical, in terms of Buddhist psychology, how does manas, which becomes greater quality, great equanimity, fit into the picture of things we are learning on the path to wholeness? So, Bill, what do you mean by manas, just so everybody understands?
Self and not of the self. And that part of the mind that knows this goes to God, we start.
Yeah. So manas is this aspect of mind we all know. It is the part. There is on one level, we might say the upper level, the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, the five senses. And there was a little confusion. Somebody, I guess Brian mentioned senses yesterday and thoughts. And I think there was a little confusion. Somebody, so I'm not sure what you said, but I'm sure you said it correctly. But, and the hearer probably misunderstood. But just in case. So the five senses, right? These are the five physical senses. We have, you know, these are the senses of our body. And each of them have object. They see. They see things, right? I mean, they don't just see, they see things, right? They don't just hear, they hear sounds. They don't just smell, they smell odors. They don't just taste, they taste flavors, thank you. And they sense sensations, positive, negative things in the body and on the, okay? So those are the five physical senses, and they give us information about the physical world, right? I mean, and if you think about what you think about, a lot of it is about, you know, things you see, things you hear, things you smell, you know, so, okay, all right? So there's lots of information coming in through our senses, as well as we have this mind. Now I'm talking about small mind, the thinking mind, the logical mind, the analytical mind, the mind that can remember. You know what I mean? We would call that sort of the functional mind, even though it's really not a separate thing. But it's by its, we define it by its function, okay? So all that's going on, right? Eyes are seeing, ears are hearing, you know, things, you know, thoughts are being generated about it, okay. Then, see, that's all fairly benign, isn't it? That's all fairly factual, right? I see a tree, I see you, I taste tea, you know what I mean? It's all, you know, there's either a positive or a negative, just kind of a natural response, right? It's all, right. Then there is this seventh level called manas, the home of self, we might say. And what this part of our mind does, it kind of organizes all this information, right? In terms of self. It is the fundamental mistake. Okay? Because it looks like there's somebody over there, right? You see? It looks like there's somebody here. Eyes, ear, you know, it looks like somebody's here. They talk and we say, oh, that's Fred, right? Now, that fundamental mistake that there is somebody solid, permanent here, and that all those experiences that I'm seeing are somehow solid and permanent, are made into a story about who? About me. So what happens is now everything that I see, hear, smell, taste, you know, is about me. That is the role of Manas. And as Bill correctly pointed out, Manas is in love with only one thing, him or herself. Which also means the things I think, my views, my ideas, my needs, my wants, my desires, all these things are so important, aren't they? To who? To me. Now, Manas is also getting information from the other way, which is the Alaya Vijnana, the storehouse consciousness. This is where the seeds of all experience, memories, all these things. So this is all the stuff that's bubbling up, right? So, self claims all that for itself too, right? My past. You know, even though it happened 40 years ago, it happened to me. Even though biologically, you know, I am not the same body I was when I was a child, right? I don't have the same cell. I mean, it's all different. And yet, we still think it happened to me, even though it's just a memory. It's because of Manas. And that is why in the practice, you know, in the path to wholeness, this Manas has to be transformed into a bodhisattvic self, a selfless self, a self that doesn't understand that even though it looks like and it feels like, that is not correct. There is nothing solid and permanent here. The senses lie to us. So in other words, if I see Chris, it looks like there's Chris, independent. But Chris is not independent. Chris is totally dependent on endless systems in his body that are all subject to sickness, old age, and death, deterioration. Chris only, he has the body he has and the face he has and the thing because of his parents and ancestors. I mean, he didn't even make this body. Right? I mean, I'm looking at Chris, but I'm really looking at his ancestors. I'm not looking at Chris. Right? He has nothing to do with this. I mean, he can grow facial hair and stuff like that or not. But I mean, you know, I mean, we have, you know what I'm saying? And he only has a temporary existence. You know, everything about him is, there are so many dependencies, all his thoughts. He didn't create his thoughts. His thoughts kind of came by causes and conditions. You know, experience has created him. But I don't see all that, right? There's no understanding, right? So when I see Chris, rather than seeing somebody who has been created by causes and conditions and try to understand the causes and conditions called understanding, you know, I don't do that. I just see this body, this physical body, what he says. I see it in terms of my own projections that are all coming from myself. And, you know, we're off and running. That has to be transformed. And as Bill pointed out, you know, that which discriminates, endlessly discriminates all in its own favor and endlessly divides up to the world, needs to be transformed in what's called the great equality, the great equanimity, which is seeing everything as equal. Seeing the sameness of. So when we talk about Manas as the center of egoism and egocentricity, because of misperception, false identification, through the practice, we are transforming that self into a bodhisattvic self that has learned that it doesn't exist in any independent way. And therefore, it has purified its emotions. Right? So the emotions that belong to self, which are what? Anger, resentment, hurt, you know, despair, fear, anxiety, you know, and on and on and on, are no longer those emotions that one feels. Instead, one feels what? Love. Kindness. Compassion, patience, understanding, you know, these are the confidence, trust, fearlessness, happiness, peacefulness. These are the emotions of the awakened self. Manas has been transformed. And a whole nother set of emotions and feelings and cognitions are now arising. No longer is Manas only looking, you know, narcissist, right? Narcissist only gazes in the water. Narcissist is always gazing at what? Himself, herself. Nothing it loves better than to look in the mirror. Right? The bodhisattva turns out. It sees others. Its concern is for others. It's a very different process. It is radically different. But this is what our path is about. So thank you for your questions. Like fresh air, Tony. Oh, that one's open. Good. Good. Maybe somebody on the other side. No, that's fine. If you're cool, that's fine. But maybe somebody who's a little good. Open. Thank you. So, yesterday we began, we're working toward the Song of the Grass Hermitage. And we began with, and the reason I'm sort of going toward it is for you to understand that this fundamental, you know, Buddhism, Zen branched off into many different directions. But I think it's important to see this early Chan, this early Zen, how simple and direct and human it was. So yesterday we learned from Bodhidharma, the founder of what became known as Zen or Chan, that he, from the beginning, basically said there are two ways. One is this way of practices, and one is this way of principle. You enter the Dharma gate through one principle, and if you remember, he said it is the principle that all beings possess the same true nature, though it is obscured and not apparent due to worldly attachment, and that if one forsakes delusion, returns to the true, fixing one gaze on the wall and forsaking all thoughts of self and other, sacred and profane, by not moving, by not chasing after scriptures or teachings, one is in accord with the principle. So there's an immediacy that says this is not a process that needs to take thousands of kalpas. That this is a gate that you can enter right now. Now, moving on to the third patriarch. Anybody know who the third patriarch is of Chan?
Name, but I know
we can't call him. Exactly, Sangsan. So, remember, we chant every morning verses on the faith mind, trust in the mind. That's attributed to the third Zen patriarch, two generations after Bodhidharma. The great way is not difficult, right? You hear the echo of Bodhidharma. The great way is not difficult, right? A lot of people go on about how difficult this path is. It's not easy to give up your views. This great way is not difficult for those who what? Do not pick and choose. How does it go, Brian? Then what does he say?
The great way is not difficult for those who do not pick and choose. Preferences cast aside, the way stands clear and undisguised.
There you go. Did everybody hear that? When preferences are set aside, the way stands clear and undisguised. Who's ready to give up their preferences? Good, their likes and dislikes. Now, I don't mean this poorly, but it's easy to say sitting here, isn't it? I'm looking at you. I'm going to write all your names down. Everybody raise their hand. I'm going to come visit you next week. But again, everything starts with intention and aspiration. But can you see? It's very clear. And there are people in here who have been chanting that for years. And yet, you know, off we go. We go home and all, it's all about picking and choosing, liking and disliking, wanting and needing, must have, must not have. And we wonder why the great way is not apparent to us. How could anyone see it in such busyness? It's interesting here, this is just personally, that I'm looking at a translation in this book, Zen's Chinese Heritage. You know, it was always very interesting to me, having started out in Zen in the 60s and 70s, and then that when I traveled to India and spent several years there studying the Tibetan Nyingma tradition, knowing nothing about it, that when I received teachings and practices of what's called the Dzogchen, Zopa Chenpo, or Great Perfection tradition, it was like hearing the teachings of a Zen master. I mean, they were the same. It was really quite profound to me. It's interesting that in this translation, the book, he actually uses the term in his translation from the Chinese, the great perfection is the same as vast space, lacking nothing, nothing extra. This tradition in Tibet is called, again, the great perfection. The great perfection is not the perfection of perfect from imperfect. It's not that. There's nothing stands in opposition, it is said here. The great perfection is the same as vast space, lacking nothing, nothing extra. Due to picking up and discarding, you will not know it. This is an interesting translation. The great perfection is the same as vast space, lacking nothing, nothing extra. Due to picking up and discarding, you will not know it. Don't chase the conditioned, nor abide in forbearing emptiness. In singular equanimity, the self is extinguished. In singular equanimity, the self is extinguished. Is that clear? Equanimity means what? What? Acceptance. But usually, right, I mean, that's sort of, but when one is equanimous, when in equanimity, one's approach to everything is what?
Without judgment.
Yeah, balance, right? Acceptance. Everything's in balance. Acceptance, no judgment. I'm equanimous. I don't judge experience. All experiences we have, we label good, bad, want, don't want. Right? Can you see everything that comes on? You know, everything that we experience, you know, is like that. There's no equanimity in that. Every person who comes in their life, we judge. Like, don't like. Want in my life, don't want in my life. Want them to be like this, don't want them to be like this. We we read the paper, we listen to the news. We can't just read it in equanimity, can we? We are constantly editorializing. This shouldn't be happening, right? Not in my world. And yet it is happening. This should be happening. But it's not happening. That's the truth. Equanimity is found in accepting things as they are. The truth of things as they are. And you could want them to be different. You can hope that they're different. You can work to make them different. That's all fine. But the bottom line is they are what they are. And if there's no equanimity, the mind is not equanimous, then we will have affliction. In singular equanimity, the self is extinguished. Because all that out of equanimity, where is it coming from? Manas. You know, what is the mechanism within my own mind that judgments, evaluations, views, likes, dislikes, preferences, judgments, desire, you know, what is the source of all that? So you have to look in your own mind. And if you look deeply enough, and you can use the Buddhist template as a map, it is this thing within me, this process is within me that takes experience, takes what's happening, and gives it a storyline, and the storyline, interestingly enough, for each of us, is always my storyline. Well, that's interesting. Right? Now, Rush Limbaugh has another storyline. Right? Interestingly enough. Right? We see it in him. But we don't see that the same thing is going on within us. The world of conflict, the world of disagreement, the world of competition, the world of competing ideas that has no openness, is because of manas. When we can educate people or do something that people begin to understand their own processes and their relationship to their own ideas, then the world will change. So, third patriarch continuing on. Now, what I want to share with you is this poem. And this poem is, is his name, see, I don't know Chinese, Shitou Xijian, Shitouxiqian. His years are 700 to 790. He is a seminal figure in the development of Zen. For those of you who are familiar with what's called Soto Zen, and I think in Chinese it was... So, anyhow, they all go back to him. He was sort of a seminal figure in the development of major schools of Zen. A little something about him. He grew up in a village. As a small child, he visited a Buddhist temple with his mother, who brought him in front of the Buddha image, told him to bow down, right? Which is very typical. Take your kid to bow down. And said to him, "This is the Buddha. Bow down." After he bowed, the child looked at the Buddha image for a while and said, "He's only a human being. If he's called a Buddha, then I want to be one too." Very interesting young child. It is said that his mother it said when his mother was pregnant, she avoided eating meat. And when he was a small child, he was untroublesome. As a young man, he was magnanimous. It is said in his village there were animal sacrifices performed to appease demons. And as a boy, he would go into the woods and destroy these altars that were set up to these demons, and he would free the animals and drive them away. This went on for several years, and the village elders were never able to stop him. He became a novice monk at the age of 13, and he was brought to the monastery temple of Master Wei Nang, who was the sixth patriarch. But very soon after that, he was Wei Nang, the great, known through the Platform Sutra, passed away, and he was not ordained as a full monk until the age of 28. And then this is interesting. He then traveled. It was fairly typical after fulfilling sort of one's monastic career, study, and all that, that if one had deeper aspiration, one would seek out a meditation master. And so at 28, he traveled north to study with Master Jinzi, who was a disciple of Wei Nang. One version of his first meeting with the master goes like this. The master asked Shitu, "Where did you come from?" And he said, "From Cao Shi," which is this the monastery of the sixth patriarch. And then the master asked him, "What did you bring with you?" Right? Very kind of innocent questions. Where did you come from? And what have you brought with you? And he said, "That which has never been lost, even before I went to Cao Chi." Then the master said to him, "Then why did you go there at all?" Right? I mean, if you say whatever you have, you've brought with you, you had even before you went to Wei Ning's temple, then why did you even bother going there, right? Logical question. And he said, "If I hadn't gone there, then how could I realize that it had never been lost?" The master approved. So this is, again, the master is testing him. What did you bring with you? Most people would think that the question is about physical things, right? Like the question, where did you come from? Because most people identify with their bodies, right? They would say, "Oh, well, my body was last in St. Pete, so I came from St. Pete." Right? We identify with our bodies. And what did you bring with you? We might say, "Well, I brought, you know, a suitcase, I brought my clothes, I brought my toothbrush, you know, I brought a few books," right? Because we identify with our physical world. We think that's us. A Zen master is trying to get us to see who we really are. So he's asking about the mind. And the mind that he's asking about is always here. It is not there. It is here. Right? It is always in the present. It is always here. But because we do not live in this Buddha mind, because we do not live in its expression in the present, we get caught up in, you know, the past and our stuff. And so the master is trying to find out, how much is this guy caught up in his stuff? So what did you bring with you? That which has never been lost even before I went to the Six Patriots Temple. He's referring about what? This mind. This Buddha mind. This awareness. It has no beginning or end. It's never lost, so it never needs to be found. It is right here. So the master, he gave him a good question, right? Because he wants to see the other side. You see, the two sides are one. Like, okay, that's a good answer, right? From the ultimate point of view. But then, you know, if your mind had never been lost and you know you always had it, then why'd you even bother going to a temple? You know, why don't you just enjoy your life? Right? Eat, drink, and be merry, right? And the master said, Shitu said, if I hadn't gone there, how could I have realized that it had never been lost? Is that clear? So we can't just get away with an intellectual understanding. So, you know. In other words, he said, I understand that my true mind has never been lost. But if I hadn't practiced, I would have never known it, really known it. That's why we go for teaching. Because if I hadn't done that, I could have never realized that I had never lost it. Is that clear? It's a beautiful answer. It is said that he had his great awakening from reading a passage from the commentaries of Seng Zhao, a disciple of the Indian translator Kuma Rajiva. The passage read, the ultimate self is empty and void, though it lacks form, the myriad things are all of its making. One who realizes that the myriad things are one's own self is no different than the sages of old. Upon reading this passage, everything became clear. The ultimate self . What is our ultimate self that is empty and void? Right now, this mind that is listening to this talk, if you look directly at it, you will see there is nothing there. It is empty and void right now. Please look. Look into this mind that is seeing and listening. When you look into this mind, what do you see? Do you see anything? An entity, a thing, a substance? There is nothing to be seen. And yet, everything, all the forms of the world, the things we see, the things we hear, the things we smell, thoughts, feelings, perceptions, the memory, they all appear in it. How miraculous. When you realize that, you are no different than the sages of old. There's some other interesting just one little teaching from his, and then we'll go to the poem. He said, our wisdom gate has been handed down from the ancient awakened ones. Without discussing levels of mystical absorption or effort at spiritual progress, we should simply actualize a direct insight that awakened mind is itself the truth. You know, I think there's a better translation over here. He says, my Dharma gate was first taught by the former Buddhas. You can see how different the translations are. I don't say you need to practice some advanced form of meditation. Just see what the Buddha saw. This mind is Buddha mind. There it is. You don't have to become an advanced meditator. You don't have to meditate all the jhanas. You don't have to go through the levels. But you have to see with the same eyes that the Buddha saw. Right now, you might say, but did he have a different eye than I did? He was a human being. So what eye did the Buddha see with that I don't have? It might be the same eye. Buddha mind, all beings, wisdom, defilement, these names of things are different, but they are all of one body. They're just words. You should each recognize your miraculous mind. Last night in meditation, you were instructed to notice this miraculous awareness. Not the objects of which you are aware, but the awareness itself. This miraculous mind that knows and sees and smells and just thinks and feels and understands. And none of that has to do with thought. You should recognize your miraculous mind. That which is listening to me is your miraculous mind. To recognize it is to see it and to know it for what it is. And you cannot do that if you're always chasing after your preferences, your thoughts, and you're looking at the world and all the objects of your senses and always playing around with them, making stories out of everything that occurs. You have to look, turn around and look at your mind to see the truth of who and what you are. As I was saying to somebody in interviews today, you know, you take a big white sheet of paper and you draw a circle on it with a pen and everybody says what? It's a circle and nobody sees the white page. We are distorted in our way we see things. We see the thoughts, but we don't see the mind in which the thoughts arise. We see the plane, but we don't see the sky. Which is bigger? Which is vaster? The plane could not move through if there was no sky. Do the fish know there's water? No. Their whole life is dependent on water. And if you asked a fish, I don't know how to speak their language, but if you could communicate and you'd say, well, tell me about water. I go, what are you talking about? Well, you know, water. They don't recognize what is the source of their life. Its essence is apart from temporary or everlasting. Its nature is without pollution or purity. It is clear and perfect. Common people and sages are the same. This mind reaches everywhere without limit. It is not constrained by limits of consciousness. The three realms, the six realms, all manifest from this mind. If this mind is like the moon reflected on water, where can there be creation and destruction? If you can comprehend this, then there is nothing that you lack. All your thoughts, all your views about yourself and others are simply reflections in the water of mind. They have no purpose out and meaning or substance outside of that. Next time you look in the mirror, notice, don't see your reflection, notice the mirror. There can be no reflection without the mirror. And that mirror has a life beyond you. You think that mirror is there for you. Show me what I can look so I can get my hair right. You know? After you are gone, you know, somebody's coming into here next week. And the mirror is going to be reflecting them. It's not your mirror. Couldn't care less about you. How you look, how you don't look, whether a hair is hanging this way or that way. The mirror just reflects. It is equanimous. It doesn't discriminate. It doesn't hold on to anything. It's not attached. It's not disturbed. You can make the most horrendous face at it. Right? You can look terrible. Your worst. The face that you want nobody else to see. And the mirror has no problem reflecting without comment. That is your true mind. That is the way it is. Any questions before we go to the poem? By the way, I did refer to Gasparilla. For those of you who aren't from Tampa, this is a big deal. It's sort of like Tampa Mardi Gras, and it's all about pirates. So you may, if you go outside today, you may wonder why there are so many boats going up and down with pirate flags, and could be people hooting and hollering. It is because it is this Gasparilla festival today. It's big doings downtown, but they like to go on the water. So you may see that today. Do not be concerned. So this is a poem, actually, Shito Shijian. He also wrote another poem called Harmony of Difference and Equality, which is translated in Japanese as a Sandokai. And if any of you have ever sat or in Soto Zen temples or meditation centers, this is often part of their liturgy. They chant this. It's quite... the Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage is I don't believe, chanted, but it is, one of the few things that have come down to us from this master. Let me read it through first, okay? And then we'll comment on it. So this is the Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage. I've built a grass hut where there is nothing of value. After eating, I relax and enjoy a nap. When the hut was completed, fresh weeds appeared. Now it's been lived in, covered by weeds. The person in the hut lives here calmly, not stuck to inside, outside, or in between. Places worldly people live, he doesn't live. Realms worldly people love, she doesn't love. Though the hut is small, it includes the entire world. And 10 feet square, an old man illumines forms and their nature. A Mahayana Buddha Bodhisattva trusts without doubt. The middling or lowly can't help wondering, will this hut perish or not? Perishable or not, the original master is present, not dwelling south or north, east or west. Firmly based on steadiness, it cannot be surpassed. A shining window below the green pines, jade palaces or vermilion towers can't compare with it. Just sitting with head covered, all things are at rest. Thus, this mountain monk doesn't understand at all. Living here, he no longer works to get free. Who would proudly arrange seats, trying to entice guests? Turn around the light to shine within, then just return. The vast, inconceivable source cannot be faced or turned away from. Meet the ancestral teachers, be familiar with their instruction. Find grasses to build a hut, and don't give up. Let go of hundreds of years and relax completely. Open your hands and walk innocent. Thousands of words, myriad interpretations, are only to free you from obstructions. If you want to know the undying person in the hut, don't separate from this skin bag here and now. How beautiful. So we are very fortunate that this has come down to us. And supposedly he lived in a hut up on a ridge above the monastery. So let us begin. I've built a hut, a grass hut, where there's nothing of value. I think this raises the point, what is of value in this life? What do I value? And when I value things, then how do I act toward them? If I value my reputation, if I value how my body looks, if I value the way I dress, if I value the way my home looks, if I value myriad things, the way I do this, the way I do that, what do I value? How valuable is this body? Most people put incredible value on their body, don't they? It is the central object in their life. I once read, I forget, what is it, if you add up all the minerals and et cetera, what's the value of a human body on the market? Not much, is it? Huh? $10, $50. $100. I mean, what is the value of a body? A physical body. For most people, it's the most valuable thing in the world. But it's really of very little value. And there are how many of them around? 6, 7, 8 billion? 7 billion of them? Yeah, so that's kind of give or take. So, I've built a great hut where there's nothing of value. When we give value to all the things of our life, when we give value to all the things of ourself, when that's what's valuable, right? Then we have a lot of work to do, don't we? I've built a grass hut where there's nothing of value. If there's nothing of value, then there's really no great attachment, is there? If your grass hut falls down, what do? Build another one. Somebody steals your grass hut, what do? Wish them well. Build another one. So again, whether he is talking about the grass hut has meaning, or whether he's using the grass hut as a kind of metaphor for the body, he's basically saying, I live in a grass hut. We live in a body. It's nothing of great value. I'm sure he took care of his grass hut, swept it out. Any holes got in it, he would add some more grass to keep it dry. You know, it doesn't mean you don't take care of your grass hut. But he understands it's nothing of great value. It's subject to impermanence. Comes and goes. After eating, I relax and enjoy a nap. There it is. Living in this sense of, this is not of great importance, my stuff, my activities, my needs, my desires, all the things I do, my to-do list, right? Our sacred to-do lists. Our sacred projects that got to get done. All so valuable, all so important. Right. Do you hear his life? After eating, I relax and enjoy a nap. There it is. Right. Natural. He's at ease. Right. When hungry, I eat. When tired, I sleep. I'm at ease. Can you see the picture? He's in his grass hut. He's at ease. When he's hungry, he eats. When he gets tired, he takes a nap. He relaxes. He's relaxed. Does that describe our life? I mean, people in our society, it's a very common thing. People say, oh, since I've retired, I am what? Busier than ever. I mean, people say that proudly. Right? Since I'm retired, I'm just busier than ever. Right? There's not enough time in the day for all the activities I want to be doing. I've built a grass hut where there's nothing of value. After eating, I relax and enjoy a nap. This expresses this these wonderful Zen teachings that are congruent with a sense of life as having its own natural rhythm, its own natural ease, right? After you've taken your dog for a walk, after you've fed him, what does he do? What? Takes a nap. He relaxes and takes a nap. We're busily on to our next project. It's like, you know, wake me up when we want to go for a walk again. You know, it's like, there it is. He's showing us the natural way. After eating, I relax and enjoy a nap. It's like that, you know, the saying of Zen, you know, what is the great way of Dharma? You know, chopping wood and carrying water. Just all the natural things of life. But we have gone so far in our society. We're so out of touch with the natural rhythm of life, of our minds, and we are just... I mean, we have sleep disorders. Right? Epidemic, sleep disorders. I mean, we can't even get tired and sleep anymore. I mean, what can be more natural than that? I mean, that shows you how out of kilter we are. How we've lost our natural rhythm of life. I built a grass hut where there's nothing of value. After eating, I relax and enjoy a nap. When the hut was completed, fresh weeds appeared. What does he say? Impermanence. Huh? You go out there, weed your garden, come out there 2 weeks later, what do you got? Weeds. That's just the natural rhythm of things. Right? That's just it. Nothing to get upset about. Nothing to, you know... just the way it is, right? You know that project you've been working so diligently on, stressing over? You know what's going to happen as soon as it's done? There's going to be another one, right? And after you, you know, work hard on that one, what's going to happen? And you finish that one, get that off your list, what's going to happen?
Another one.
When the hut was, look, this is, what, 5th, 6th century? He already knew it. When the hut was completed, fresh weeds appeared. There it is. Across the ages, he's trying to wake us up. As soon as you get one thing done and you think it's completed, there's going to be another. That's just the way it is. Why stress? Why rush around like crazy people? Taking yourself and everybody else miserable. Taking your life so seriously. And your project so seriously. When the hut was completed, fresh weeds appeared. Now it's been lived in. Covered with weeds. Right? There it is. He's also talking about the body, right? That we've been living in. The longer around we get, the more weeds. Right? Now it's been lived in, covered by weeds. Now somebody who thinks there should not be weeds in life. And there are people like that. Some of them could be sitting here. Right? As soon as they get up in the morning, they see a weed, what do? They get out their weed whacker. Get that weed off. Right? Anything goes wrong in life, anything happens that they don't want to happen, right away they're stressed out. Upset. Agitated, angry, resentful, hurt, disappointed, scared. I mean, right? Oh my God, the weeds are coming back. What are we going to do? It's been lived in, covered by weeds. Now listen to this. The person in the hut lives here calmly. There's the teaching. There's the teaching. In the midst of all this impermanence and change and things happening this way and that way, right? In the midst of that, can we be at peace? Can we be calm? Right? In our bodies, with its changing, its aging, its sickness, old age, and death, and all that stuff, can we be peaceful? Can we be calm? Right? In the midst of your activities, And here we would call activities weeds. Can you be calm? At the center of it. We think if there are things to do, we have to be agitated. We have to be stressed. We have to kind of ramp up, you know. But that's not the case at all. In the midst, he says, the house is covered with weeds. But inside, I am calm. Because I do not take my happiness or unhappiness based on weeds and how the weeds are growing. Many of us live our life endlessly concerned about the outer things and projects and activities and how they're going and how they're seen and how they're perceived, right? And because of that, we are stressed, we are anxious, we are scared, we are sad, we are, right? Because we're all just wrapped around the weeds. And the weeds grow. The person in the hut lives here calmly, not stuck to inside, outside, or in between. Okay? Do you hear? Stuck. We get stuck. Things aren't going our way. We get stuck. We fixate. Something's got to get done today. We fixate. We get stuck on it. And we lose our equanimity. We lose our calmness because we let it agitate us. Why does it agitate us? Because we're stuck on it. Is that clear? It's not because of the situation, the external situation. It's because of our mind is stuck. We get stuck outside, we get stuck inside, we get stuck in between. We get stuck on stuff out there, we get stuff that's arising in our mind, and we get stuck on how they interplay. Stuck means what? There's no flow. Things aren't moving when they're stuck. And that's the way our mind and our emotions occur. We go from one stuckness to another stuckness. A little bit of break in between. All right, can you see it? Because we fixate, we get fixed on. And it becomes all important. Everything's out of proportion. Now it's been lived in, covered with weeds. Just the way it is. Brian told me this morning he thinks he's getting sick again. Right? He just got over it. He was sick, and now look at it. Just when you were reveling in your happiness, being healthy over there. Oh, poor Alex, sick guy. But you're quite happy that you weren't sick. What happens? Weeds. Weeds growing, right? Alex wanted to come retreat. We're looking forward to feeling great. Weeds. We all have weeds. They're part of this life. But the upset at, the distress at, is because we imagine in our delusion a world without weeds. A world without sickness, old age, and death. In our imagination, we imagine such a world. So when sickness, old age, and death occur, we are overwhelmingly distressed. Because why? Because if we admit it, it's because we imagined a world without it. We imagine a world without weeds, where everything goes our way. Right? I imagine a world where everybody treats each other with kindness. Right? And there is justice. And people care for each other, and they care for the earth, and everyone is taking care of one another. Right? But that world exists where? Only in my imagination. That doesn't mean in my own little way I don't make efforts for that type of world. But I understand that is not the world that we live in, is it? It just exists in my imagination. The world is what it is. People are who they are. That is the truth. So here it is. The person who lives in the hut lives here calmly, not stuck to inside, outside, or in between. Please examine your life to see where you are stuck. If you are not calm in your life, if you are not at peace in your life, if you experience anger and stress and fear and all those things, it is because there is something about the way you are living your life in relationship to the weeds that has got you stuck. Places worldly people live, he doesn't live. Realms worldly people love, she doesn't love. Now, Shitu Shijian, he's obviously a hermit, isn't he? So this is quite physical, what he's saying. He really doesn't. He doesn't live where people live, and he doesn't visit or love all the things that worldly people love. He has separated himself from it. But I think what he says is very important for us who live in the world. Worldly people means people who are attached to the world and the things of this world. People who live in this world attached to the things of this world, they find their pleasure and happiness in the activities of that world. A person who is a not worldly person can live in the world but is not attached to the things of the world, nor does it see the things and the activities of the world as their source of happiness and well-being. Is that clear? Worldly people are not happy. They are happy when things are going their way. They appear happy. Right? Rich people may appear happier than poor people. People in South Tampa may appear happier than people on Nebraska Avenue. Nebraska Avenue is where our center is. It's a poor part of town. Now, why is that? Because people in South Tampa have more money. They have nicer houses. Their kids go to better school. You know, they have lots of good things that make them happy. Right? People in poorer part of towns don't have those things. But people in South Tampa are not intrinsically happier in any way. Because if you put them on Nebraska Avenue, they will be immediately what? Unhappy. Their happiness is only predicated on their life of ease and luxury that comes from wealth. Right? It is not a deep happiness. And even in South Tampa, the flames of impermanence, of sickness, old age, and death, of gain and loss, and the afflictions that are brought upon by self are rampant. That is why when you pull back, covers, when you pull back the screen and you see, oh, this one's on this antidepressant, this one's on this anti-anxiety, this one's on this chemical, this one's an alcoholic, this one's a this, this one is a shopaholic, this one's a, oh, well, how can that be? Because they are stuck. It's important to understand that. So we can live in the world and not be attached to it. This is not a rant against South Tampa, by the way. I lived for 25 years in Naples, Florida. South Tampa is not even close to what goes on down there. But we have to understand that the ways of the world are only giving fleeting pleasures. And when difficulties arise, those fleeting pleasures that you get from these things will not mitigate your suffering. And it is often your very attachment to these things that become the cause of your suffering. So therefore, practitioners like ourselves, even though we live in the world, so many of the places that worldly people, you know, you get together with worldly people, what do they talk about? Restaurants. I mean, it's bizarre to me. The latest restaurants. These people talk about this. Like it's important. You know what I'm saying? You know? I mean, I could go on, but I... And again, there's nothing wrong with a restaurant, please understand. But I'm saying as important conversation, you know, restaurants, massage therapists, you know. I mean, it's like, this is what people talk about. Spas. Trader Joe's. I mean, it's like... Again, I'm not saying anything negative about Trader Joe's. I'm talking about that this, you know, that this is so dominant, this is so important. I mean, a Trader Joe's, I should get off. But I'll just finish. I mean, a Trader Joe's was coming to St. Pete. You know, if the Buddha came to St. Pete, there would not be such excitement. You know? It was like the second coming, you know? I mean, things are just a little out of whack. That's all I'm trying to say. Okay. Places worldly people live, he doesn't live. Realms worldly people love, she doesn't love. Is that clear? Does everybody understand what I'm saying? This is not, you know, that we all need to go live up in a grass hut. But it's easier in a certain way if you live up there. Right? It's easier in a certain way. But those of us who have chosen, or life has chosen us, to live in the world, and not to reject the world, and to actually want to be in the world, to help transform the world, have to understand that the endless diversions that worldly people have devised to keep themselves from facing themselves and feeling what they feel and facing the emptiness, the deep emptiness of their lives and meaninglessness of their lives, they have filled it with endless activities that appear pleasurable. But there is no substance in those experiences. They are junk experiences. and we have to see that. So we give our time to things that are meaningful, that really produce some intrinsic value, such as taking a nice walk on a beautiful day. It doesn't cost anything, does it? So we'll stop here. It is just about 12:10. Lunch is at 12:30. Please enjoy outdoor walking meditation. And just let the mind, calm down.